There is a lot going on for the month of February. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Great to be back with you on the air out there in radio land and in podcast land for those of you who listen to our show on podcast. Mm-hmm. It's plenty cold today. It's not as cold as it was last night because last night I got up in the morning. It was 15 below zero. Today it was only 5 below. So it's a real heating trend.
Yes. Well, I think the reason why, Chuck, is because we're recording this on Wednesday before Saturday. That last night, as we're referencing, is Tuesday night. And Tuesday night there was an awful lot of hot air that came out of Washington, D.C. And I think most of our listeners will know what I'm speaking of. It was the State of the Union address given by President Barack Obama to a packed house, let's put it that way, of all the politicos who hope to either be excused or pardoned by this president at some point.
Well, as always, as has become my habit in the last decade or so, I did not waste time watching it because generally what it is, it's a feel-good speech. There is a constitutional purpose for the State of the Union address. And really what's supposed to happen is that a president of the United States is basically supposed to send a report to Congress, usually at least once during his term, not necessarily once a year, but once during his term to report on what he views as the quote-unquote State of the Union. Well, it's been basically turned into a PR and a campaign thing.
Well, and that's it has been a tradition now for a while that the sitting president annually reports upon the state of our union. Well, you know, Charles, you're right. The Constitution doesn't mandate that. It just mandates that he send a report to the Congress. They've chosen to do it in this big fashion. Now, for the record, I didn't bother to watch live any of the speech. However, I was at a location in the hour and a half or so leading up to that 9 o'clock speech, and I couldn't help but laugh because it was almost as if we were being blessed by a rare visit from royalty, the way CNN was handling it with a countdown clicker that was up, you know, time left until the president's speech, and then, you know, they had this, you know, president's car leaving, motorcade now leaving the station, etc. You know, cuts to the outside, and you know, president's motorcade now entering the such and such. I'm thinking to myself, okay, let's stop here for a moment and think back upon our founding documents. Alexander Hamilton must be laughing uproariously in his grave right now because we've basically all but given him what he asked for at the Constitutional Convention, which was a constitutional monarchy.
Yeah, a king.
A king.
Basically, what that whole State of the Union thing was supposed to be for was to give the executive branch, who was basically on duty all the time, a report to Congress so they knew what he knew from the fact that he's on duty all the time. Because Congress was only supposed to meet for a few months, sometimes once every 2 years. Very often, and it turned very quickly into a few months, basically once a year. And the president would use that as, you know, here's the state of the military, here's the state of defense, here's the state of diplomacy, here's our trade condition at this point. Here's my recommendations for what to do about it. Well, what it's turned into is it basically a way for the president to come out and say, well, if Congress doesn't do that, then I'm going to wield the pen. I have a phone and I have a pen, and therefore, if you guys don't fix this, I'm going to do this for you.
There's just a slight issue.
Yeah, there's that, a mix, there's a slight issue.
There's
yeah.
a small issue, and it's called the Constitution of the United States. I believe that Article 2 is, well, maybe not silent to the idea of executive order, but it does create some, shall we say, boundaries around the operation of executive orders. they're only to be used for directing executive branch agencies that are under the control of the executive. That would be for such things as, well, saying that certain agencies can't have X amount of overtime, you know, that kind of thing. What we've come to find with executive orders, and Barack Obama is not the only poster child for this problem.
He's the most blatant about it.
Yeah. Presidents going back and even including Rinaldus Magnus, Ronald Reagan, used executive orders to stretch the boundary of authority well beyond its original intent by our founders.
And a lot of people don't know this. They built on the foundation laid by Theodore Roosevelt. Theodore Roosevelt was a master, and very much like Barack Obama in the way he used the executive order. The executive order is one of those things that's called that some people call an implied power. There aren't any implied powers in the Constitution. There are concomitant powers. In other words, powers that go along with the things that are part and parcel of the things that are given in the Constitution to the various branches. Well, what that means, what as Barry stated, the purpose for the executive order was to force, sometimes, for instance, a cabinet officer would refuse to do his duty or would be dragging his feet or would shirk some responsibility. And the president had the power to issue an order to that head of department and say, get to work on this. I want this done. This is the law. And it was part of the president's job in his duties to enforce, make sure, I believe the phraseology is to make sure that all laws are carried out.
Yes, that is the phraseology.
That's what the executive order's for. Now suddenly, since Theodore Roosevelt, the power has been used to say, well, Congress isn't acting on this, and therefore we're going to seize control of this area because we think we have the constitutional authority to do it. Well, what that means is somebody will look at Article 1, Section 8 and look at the Necessary and Proper Clause, and they would apply the Necessary and Proper Clause, which basically says that we'll have all authority to make laws, making sure that we exercise the powers that we've been given. And Article 1, Section 8 powers are very, very limited. Well, that has been used to expand the authority of Congress. And in fact, when we went through the dog and pony show after John Boehner became the Speaker of the House, where we read the Constitution from the well of the House.
Which we've now done for the last two Congresses.
Right. And there was a standing rule in the House that I think is still there, but it's being ignored, that basically says when you submit a bill, you have to include the article and section of the Constitution that gives you the authority to do that. Well, everybody that issued one said Article 1, Section 8. So it became laughable, kind of a joke. As they went into this thing, everybody said Article 1, Section 8. Well, the part of Article 1, Section 8 that they were all citing was the Necessary and Proper Clause. Congress shall have all power necessary. I'm paraphrasing here. Congress shall have all power necessary to make sure that these powers are used properly. So essentially, I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah, you're paraphrasing the law. I think what it says is that Congress shall have all authority to pass necessary legislation to enact this section.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's what it says, yeah.
So basically what they're saying is, well, that gives us power to do anything.
En contraire, mon frère. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. And so all the president is doing is claiming that, well, since Congress won't act, I'm going to implement the Necessary and Proper Clause myself. Now, I've always laughed about this, Bear. I can remember way back, we were talking years ago. There was a discussion on one of these talking heads giving their analysis of something that was going on. This is not related to what we're talking about now, but to show you the muddled thinking about the Constitution. This talking head, who supposedly was this big brainiac, basically came out and it was a talk about the writ of habeas corpus and how it could be suspended. Well, that particular section is in Article 1. And the only thing mentioned in Article 1 are the powers left to Congress.
Yes.
Article 1 is specifically about the legislative authority, and the only power to suspend the writ of habeas corpus is in Article 1.
Is in Article 1 in Congress.
Yes. So it's not even an implication. It is essentially explicitly stated that only Congress can suspend the writ of habeas corpus, and it can only do it in times of a national emergency.
Correct.
Okay. This talking head was out there blathering on and on and on about, says the Constitution says you can suspend the writ of habeas corpus, does it? But it doesn't say who can do it. And therefore, if the president does it, it's okay. And I'm like, well, it's in Article 1. There's no mention of it in Article 2. So can the president suspend the writ of habeas corpus?
I think not.
No, and it doesn't matter if Congress is in session or not. This is where we got into trouble in the Civil War, because Abraham Lincoln did this in the opening months of the Civil War, because in approximately March or April of 1861, Congress adjourned.
Mm.
So what happened on April 12th? Or was it April 12th or April 9th? I can never remember. I think it's April 12th, I believe.
Oh, in 1864, did you say?
One.
Or 1861. A little thing called Fort Sumter.
Yeah. So what... really, Lincoln's duty at that point was to call Congress back into session. So you guys need to come back.
Yes.
But no, his big thing was, no, I'm going to rule as one man until they come back to their scheduled time to come back into session.
Right.
Which was months away. So basically, he said, well, I need the power. I need to be able to in order to save the Union, I have to have the power to rescind the writ of habeas corpus, which he did. He did a whole lot of other things as well. He called for volunteers. He was going to go he was basically going to go to war without congressional approval. Well, where have we seen that before?
Numerous times.
Yeah.
Numerous times. Does the Gulf of Tonkin resolution mean anything to you?
Yeah, exactly.
But you know what, Chuck? In this environment we have today, Barack Obama is actually talking about utilizing the power of the executive pen for, and I'll just give you a short laundry list of things. Raising the federal minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. Now, he's going to do this by saying that he's going to require that any contractor that has a contract with the federal government must pay that minimum rate. And, of course, in his speech on Tuesday night, he talked about, well, people who are washing the dishes and taking care of our troops shouldn't live in poverty. Well, big problem with that, Chuck, even if he does this, he can't make it retroactive. So therefore, it's only going to apply to any new contracts with federal agencies, which, if you think about it, Charles, is going to either one of two things are going to have to happen. They're going to have to raise the amount of the contracts in order to get agencies to bid on it because they have to pay that minimum wage, or there are going to be fewer entities who are going to bid on federal contracts, thus creating a preference monopoly.
Yeah.
For certain ones who, probably magically over time, will end up getting certain exemptions from the administration so that they really just don't have to follow that.
Well, what it does is it forces small companies out of the pool for bidding on those contracts, which means that there are lots of little mom and pops that make this part or that part or another part very often who don't work directly for the government. They work for a contractor, guaranteed, Barry,
mm-hmm.
that will trickle down to those mom-and-pop operations. Okay, the government says, we can't use that part. We can't use your widget unless you're complying with that federal order.
Right. Well, that's what they did in California. I mean, at state level, and that was with the homosexual issue. If you wanted to get a contract with the state of California to do anything, have any kind of engagement, well, and it started in San Francisco. They did it in San Francisco first, that if you wanted contracts with the city, you had to basically have non-discrimination policies in place. And then they expanded that statewide. Well, you know where Obama's going to go with this.
Of course.
Of course there is. I mean, it wasn't an accident that a certain well-known sports figure who, quote-unquote, came out of the closet was one of the special guests sitting next to Michelle Obama at the State of the Union speech. You know, they really... This is a showpiece, Chuck.
When I laughed
about CNN earlier with the countdown, like, you know, oh, so many minutes left. It's like the ball dropping on New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
You know that this is all a big production. Well, every bit of it is handled for PR purposes. Every bit of it. And his saying that he's going to raise the minimum wage to $10.10 is exactly that, because what they've done now is, even though, if you start thinking about it, the vast majority of federal contracts are going to companies who probably
are well over the minimum
wage, what it does is it creates a soundbite that they can use coming into the midterm elections to talk about how, you know, if you oppose the president in this executive order, i.e., if Congress says, wait a minute, that's our prerogative because that's a budgetary issue, so you can't do that because it's here, you know, we handle all of the appropriations measures by the Constitution. So that's going to be difficult for you to pull off. Well, then it's going to look like, well, they're opposed to have people having a real living wage, Charles. Even though very few, if none of the people who would actually fall for that kind of propaganda would ever benefit from the action he's taking. But the whole key is it's the big push to get young people, lower income people, inner city people, to come out in mass and vote Democrat.
Sure.
That's the whole deal, folks.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it really gets down to. Now, granted, the Republicans are not going to be doing much better because, you know, they're, on the other hand, they're sitting there basically going to give way on the budget. They're going to give way on what looks like on amnesty.
Immigration and amnesty.
Yeah.
But they're going to do it after the deadline for they're not going to take this up until after the deadline for filing for primaries,
which is actually next week.
Yes. Yeah. In this state, I think maybe some other states might be a little later, but not much.
I know West Virginia is this week. Well, Ohio's next week. By the beginning of March, pretty much everybody's filed.
I was
going to
say, no later than April, I don't think.
Yeah, somewhere around March or April, everybody has filed. So, again, the point is they're going to take it up because the Republicans are under this delusion that voting blocks that have historically never voted for you before all of a sudden will start voting for you because you've given them what the people they are voting for has been promising them for decades.
Guess what, folks? Ronald Reagan got suckered into that in the mid-1980s. Guess what didn't happen?
A massive wave of votes for Republicans from those people who have historically not voted Republican before.
And there are enough people around that remember that everybody says, look, this is not going to happen. And which brings me to a point to say, that's not really what it's about anyway.
Sure. You're right. It's not. That's not really what it's about.
This is about basically groups like, well, let's take a look at it. Who's for immigration reform? The Chambers of Commerce.
Sure.
And the Chambers of Commerce are for it because fast food places really like to be able to hire people, no skilled workers, who will work really cheap.
Sure.
So, and contractors who basically want to have a lot of illegals working for them, who want to be able to get those illegals in under the amnesty umbrella so they don't face any possible fines or any problems because they hired these people in the first place. there are all kinds of big business really want this labor pool, this unskilled labor pool that they can pay very small wages to because... Uh-huh. Unfortunately, or fortunately, one or the other, American workers basically tend to demand higher salaries, whether they earn them or not. That's another question, and that's a subject for another talk. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that big businesses want access to a cheap labor pool.
Of course they do.
And the only way to do it is to allow this immigration. And we also know from what we know about how Social Security works, that the feds want this because, frankly, Barry, we've murdered 57 million babies.
Right.
Since 1973.
Right. So basically, in this country. We've cut off our ability to actually keep things like Social Security and Medicare solvent.
Afloat. That's right. The only thing to keep it afloat, because it is a Ponzi scheme, in other words, it has to have a continually broadening base.
Exactly. So you have to now find new ways of broadening the base, which is bringing in illegals.
That's right. The only way to bring people into that pool is to make them legal, so they have to pay Social Security, and they have to pay Medicaid, and they have to pay all those taxes.
Okay, now think about this too, Chuck, because it also it's a two-edged sword. Because on the one hand, if you do this, all of a sudden your unemployment rate starts looking less, because now all these illegals can actually be reported as employed, and so therefore it's going to gin your unemployment rates lower, so then Obama can ride on that as well, that we've taken care of the unemployment problem. However, in looking at analysis from the speech, we now have more people who have stopped looking for work than who have gotten jobs.
Yeah, right.
Now, big part of that problem is, Charles, and you mentioned it, with Chambers of Commerce looking for cheap labor, a lot of the jobs that could be going to American citizens are going to undocumented illegals who are not reported, and so therefore those jobs don't get mixed into the labor pool.
Right.
We got a big problem on that end. Now, if we legalize and give amnesty, all of a sudden we'll have less unemployment, but the same people who are being impacted negatively right now with the lack of jobs won't find it to be any easier. They'll actually find it to be tougher.
Well, okay, to quote Mark Twain, there are three kinds of lies. I won't do the direct quote because we're on a Christian.
Lies, blankety blank lies, yeah. And statistics.
Lies, black lies, white lies, black lies, and statistics. And right. This is one of those places where statistics have been lying to us this entire time. We're told we're in the middle of a
recovery
where 94 million people are out of the job pool who used to be in the job pool and aren't looking anymore.
Yeah, and folks, and if you don't know the numbers, 94 million is 30% of the American population.
Yeah, so someone is out there, and I can't remember who, I should have kept the article, is basically saying the real unemployment picture is about 32%. That's a depression.
Yes, it is.
Now, there are those of us who are okay. I lost a lot of money last year, so for reasons that have nothing to do with... Well, they have something to do with government regulation, but
yes.
But there are people out there, and let's not kid ourselves. It's not just people in the middle income area. There are a lot of people out there who used to be corporate types, who are now basically managers in Walmarts and that kind of thing. Again, not a bad job, but certainly not the. Maybe five figures that they're used to, six figures that they're used to.
Right.
The standard of living is beginning to fall. Let me give you, for instance, I have a new client, and we were talking, and she said, "Well, I used to be in Hawaii, but I had to." And I said, "Because I asked her, what made you move from Colorado? Why would you move from Hawaii to back to Colorado?"
Right.
And she said, "Money." She said, "Hawaii is one, very expensive to live in,
yes.
And two, there is no spare money there. There's no floating cash."
Right.
And that's the kind of thing you run into when you create a two-tier society,
mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what government's messing with the economy has done.
Yes.
You've got the very rich and the very poor, and everybody in the middle who are doing services like massage, holistic kind of healing medicine, that kind of thing, which is what I'm involved in.
Sure.
They're squeezed out, because when you're basically wondering if you're going to be able to buy groceries for the next week, the last thing you're going to do is go get a massage.
Well, yeah, or do anything else like preventative care.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what's happening in our economy. People in the middle are starting to get squeezed out. This is why, for instance, you may or may not know this, but there are, wow, what was that? We don't know.
Not sure.
There are companies, restaurant companies, and I actually predicted this. There are restaurant companies like Olive Garden, Red Lobster, TGI Fridays, anybody you can think of in that sort of middle, sit down and have a meal served to you kind of environment.
Niche, yeah.
It's not Wendy's, it's not McDonald's.
It's not fast food, but it's not fine dining but it's, either. Yeah. It's more like slow food.
It's casual sit down, sure, have a chat, sure, talk about things and yeah, somebody brings you, you know, and it's a nice place to go. They're being squeezed out of the market. And the reason is obvious. Why should you go pay for two people $70 to have a seafood dinner at Red Lobster when you can make the same dinner at home for two? I'm talking about $70 for two people.
Right.
Why should you do that when you can do it at home for about $20?
Well, I was going to say for probably less than a third of what it would cost you to do it out. Yes.
$20, $25, you can do the same thing. And everybody's looking at it and say, well, that's right. Now, what does that do? It throws not only the wait staff out of a job when those kind of places are in trouble, and they are in trouble. Olive Garden's in trouble. Red Lobster's in trouble. TGI Fridays is in trouble. They're all, there's a whole group of those that are in trouble. It throws everybody into a limbo the wait staff, the kitchen staff, management staff. Now, all of a sudden, what are those, if those chains close and everybody goes to the high end and the low end, what's going to happen to the wait staff who used to rely on getting a 15 to 20% tip on a $70 bill?
They'll be either heading to the low end and trying to push out those who have already figured out how to exist on lower wages, or they'll be hitting the unemployment line.
Exactly. So basically what this is going to do is force more people out of the job market. So that number is going to change from 94 million people. How high can it go? Well, that's a real question, isn't it? We have 315 million people in this country. We're already past the point where 50% don't work. So less than 50 are supporting the other 50.
Yeah, well, that's an upside-down scenario, Chuck, and that cannot sustain itself. So, no. You know, but the point is, though, according to the president, everything's rosy. You know, all the indicators that he threw out there, which if you look on some of the sites, PolitiFacts and others that actually track whether or not they've told some whoppers, well, they've said they've told some serious whoppers here, because they're playing fast and loose with the statistics. It just doesn't equate.
White lies, black lies, and statistics.
But you know what? You don't have to worry about it when you know that your opposition really doesn't oppose you anymore.
No.
That, you know, he's saying that, you know, we need to get some of these issues and agendas, like the minimum wage, like I don't think he even has to go to the executive pen on the amnesty issue, because congressional Republicans are already going to fold.
They're
going to
pass
one. As soon as the Chamber of Commerce came out, all of a sudden, that's where their money basket is, and so they had to fold. But they're going to fold on something else, Chuck, and it's clear right now. And they're going to fold over the debt ceiling, the debt limit, again. Now, this time, they're really going to fold the cards. Now, I take this art from an article in a blog site called Fire Dog Lake, which, if you've never read it before, is a fairly conservative blog site, political blog site. And it basically says, this is an article by John Walker, says, it appears enough of the congressional Republicans realized the debt limit is not a point of leverage over President Obama. In other words, he's going to use his executive pen just to do whatever he feels like, whether it costs or not. So their best option is just to quickly raise it. We will likely get a clean increase with relatively little drama. And he quotes from Politico, which is another political website, quote, the most senior figures in the House Republican Conference are privately acknowledging that they will almost certainly have to pass what's called a clean debt ceiling increase in the next few months, abandoning the central fight that has defined their three-year majority. The reason for the shift in dynamics in this fight is clear. Congress has raised the debt limit twice in a row without drastic policy concessions from President Barack Obama and Senate Democrats, essentially ceding the ground to the Dems. Obama and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid are again ruling out negotiations over the nation's borrowing limit, which would leave Republicans fighting against a unified Democratic front. It's a tricky situation for the GOP in an election year. They would have to pass a clean debt limit bill or risk default. Chuck, you know what that's called? That's called a Hobson's choice.
Yeah, that's a Hobson's choice.
And it's funny because John Boehner's the one who led them there. If you're going to blame anybody for the reason why Barack Obama thinks he can stand up in front of the country and say, Congress is getting in my way and I really don't need them anymore, look no further than to the Speaker of the House who was standing behind him with the gavel.
Well, this is the man who just went on Jay Leno and basically said, when asked about the working with the Tea Party, he said, look, I've learned that I have to work with every jackass that walks in the door.
Yeah, which means that he's, well, and he's got a primary. See, that's the key, Chuck. I think it's going to be filed next week, but he has a primary from the Tea Party movement. And so that's probably the reason why his, shall we say, rhetoric was a little spicy on the Leno program.
Well, plus the fact that the guy has done nothing but bungle since he's taken that particular job.
Well, you know, and he doesn't consider it bungling. He considers it being mature in office and reasonable and, well, let's just say the word, moderate. And that's been the big problem because ultra-liberals, ultra-partisans like Barack Obama, like Harry Reid, like Nancy Pelosi, no weakness when they see it, and they know how to exploit it or destroy it. And guess what? They've exploited John Boehner long enough. Now comes the time to destroy him.
Yes.
And that's what the SOTU was all about last night, was we are going to annihilate congressional Republicans, period. They're not worried about the Senate.
No.
They're going to take out the House, and they're going to take it out. Why else would he also say, you know what, we're going to push, now you won't see this happen until probably after the midterm elections, but, you know, by executive order, we're going to implement more national gun control. Can't get Congress to do it.
Therefore, we're going to use the pen,
Therefore, we're going to use the pen. Now, you can't use that pen and push that gun control, or you can't use that pen to sign a bill because too many congressional Republicans won't stand up for gun control.
Yeah. One thing I'm going to say. Fire Dog Lake is not a conservative blog.
I take that back.
It's on the blue side. We often go to a place called Paul Earls, PolUrls.com.
Yep.
And what it does is it lists different blog sites in three columns, a blue column, a purple column, and a red column.
Yep.
Fire Dog Lake is in the blue column, and the blue column is definitely liberal. I mean, you have groups like Paul Krugman.
Yeah, well, you can
Huffington Post, just Media Matters.
Edit that out before we send it. No, I'm just kidding. No, folks, sometimes I make mistakes because we've got so much stuff in front of us. Sometimes it's hard to remember where you got it from.
And let's not let everybody forget that because someone is on the left side of the scale doesn't mean they're necessarily wrong.
That's right. Well, that's true. That's true. But, you know, Chuck, what it gets right down to is what the president's talking about has a lot of things that are of concern. It's what others around him have been talking about that should be raising everybody's hackles because I can see it being locked in. Now, one of our favorite liberals, and this is coming from a website that I know is not liberal, Fox News, okay?
Yeah.
One of our favorite liberals, Al Gore, has really, you know, who had started like meandering off into relative political obscurity lately because of his disastrous support of global warming issues, has decided that, you know what, it's time to revive the media machine and get some press. Well, Chuck, I don't think that anything that the left does is done without a lot of targeting and a lot of strategic planning ahead of time. So this is the reason why these comments from Al Gore should be taken more seriously than not. And basically, he's still on the global warming kick, but he's now saying that instead of, you know, Congress passing laws to, you know, create smaller carbon footprints and carbon credits for companies, you know, except for him and his jet, which flies around and burns up a lot of carbon, we've got a new way, a central way of fighting global warming. And the words he used were, and I'll say it, fertility management. Now, ladies and gentlemen, he's not talking birth control here.
Okay. No, he's not.
Fertility management has probably all of the baggage loaded. Play the suspenseful music, and what's that shadow around the corner implications that you think it has? Al Gore is basically saying we have to do a 1984/Brave New World approach, and we have to tell people who can and can't have children and how many you can have, and government needs to step in to manage the world's fertility. In other words, government's going to act as God and decide who can and who can't recreate, procreate. And it's kind of frightening because he is really saying, and he said this in a speech at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. You know, we've heard about that before. And he was on a panel called Changing the Climate for Growth and Development. And they were, and he was there with the UN Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, Bill Gates, founder of Microsoft and multi-billionaire, shall we say, philanthropist who gives to leftist causes, and the Prime Minister of the Norwegian Prime Minister Erna Solberg. Now, what he said was, he says that, you know, because the world is expected to have more than 9 billion people by 2075, which honestly, Chuck, I'm not sure that really those numbers are going to hold tight. With most of that growth coming from developing countries in Africa, he says that basically we need to make fertility management ubiquitously available.
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 Mandatory is the actual phrase that they're looking for.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. But you know, but that's really kind of worrisome, Chuck, if you think about it, because, hey, great economic development, the historic viewpoint, Adam Smith, Wealth of Nations,
mm-hmm.
Free market economics, is large families and family-based businesses. Micro-enterprise, economic entrepreneurship. No, for Al Gore, none of those things apply because, well, we've got to manage the fertility of the world so that we can reduce global warming. And if we reduce global warming, then we're going to have all this great economic development. Did you know it was all the sun's fault, Chuck, that we just can't get out of the recession?
Well, of course, this is silly. Basically, in Africa, Al Gore's what Al Gore and his cronies have done there has really stifled economic development. These guys are basically sitting around. Of course, Africa's all for the idea of Al Gore's big plan to force everybody to do carbon credits.
Yes.
Because what is basically happening there is they're all sitting around waiting for us to pay the carbon credits so all the money will shift over to the third world, where whenever you do something like that, whenever you take money out of someone else's pocket by force and give it to somebody else, does it ever become productive? Well, only in very rare cases. What happens is that money gets spent. And then it doesn't go around again. It doesn't get spent on development. It gets spent on stuff. When you put money into an entrepreneur's pocket, basically, yes, does he live high on the hog? Yeah, to an extent, of course he does. That's kind of his whole motivation. That is exactly the motivation of why entrepreneurs do what they do. They want to do what they do because they want to get rich. But they know the way to get rich. And this is the difference between an entrepreneur and someone who just basically wins the lotto, which is what happens in these carbon credit things. Somebody wins the lotto, somebody loses. What the difference is, they put money back into the system and say, if I'm going to get more money, I got to keep getting money back in. So the way to do that is to put money out into something that's going to be productive. Mm-hmm. That's why entrepreneurs look for things that are going to coming trends for yes. things that are going to be successful. That's why guys like Elon Musk can put money into PayPal and make a ton of money and then waste a whole bunch of it by coming up with an electric car that costs $100,000 plus a copy. And they make a big deal out of the fact that one car was able to go coast to coast. So far, we've had one car that's been able to drive coast to coast with all these supercharging stations.
Oh boy.
That you got to stop every 200 miles and recharge your car. Well, okay. Would Musk have done this if he didn't have 10 tons of government subsidies? In other words, you and me paying for him to do the research?
Listen, I'll tell you what. If somebody wants to pay my freight, I'll go do a lot of things.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Hey, wonderful. You know? If I can get a third party like government to take all your money and then hand it to me in the form of a grant so I can go off and say, look at the tensile properties of a light projectile upon animal flesh, i.e. go bow hunting all the time.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm going to do it. You know, give me the money. I'll do it. No, I wouldn't do that because it's ridiculous. But our big problem is, Chuck, saying that fertility management is the key to both
right
economic development and global warming. Okay, Al Gore has now firmly entrenched himself in a certain camp.
Yes.
Because let's use the real term for fertility management, which is a euphemism. The real term is eugenics.
Eugenics, sure.
It's the dream that Margaret Sanger and the founder of Planned Parenthood had since the 19-teens that has been foisted upon the world for time immemorial. And that is the idea that, well, you know, we've got the population's out of control and we're using up all the natural resources and certain people shouldn't breed. I mean, that's really what eugenics gets down to is we're the elite. We're the experts. That'd be Sanger and her crew, including Al Gore. And that we need to determine for everybody else who lives, who dies, who succeeds, who fails, who has economic success and who doesn't. Because we have a plan for the world. We are God. And salvation only comes through us. That's really at the core of right. what Al Gore's talking
about.
And
I was thinking about the same thing, because if you think about, Al Gore is talking in terms of the Western, what has become the Western way of thinking about success. That is, that in order to have economic success, you have to have both male and female working in a marriage or in a
sure.
in a relationship,
right?
In order for it to pay. So, in other words, in order to have two Lexuses in the front and a 68-inch TV screen and all these goodies and things, you have to have two parties working. And in order to do that, you have to have as few children as you can get away with. Everybody, oh, well, I'd like to have maybe two kids. Well, folks, two children per family means that you're below the sustainability rate, which is what we've been talking about when we talked about earlier, when we talked about the reasons that we had to bring people into Mexico. One of the reasons that we have 57 million aborted babies in this country has nothing to do with the stated reasons. It has to do with economics and personal need. So in other words, when you think in terms biblically, the way that you have success economically is to have multiple children and to have basically a family type business.
Yes.
That's the biblical model.
Yes, it is.
Can that be done in a modern society? You bet it could.
Oh, sure can.
Sure it can. Now, the modern way of looking at economic success is, no, you mom and dad basically go out and work and become tax creators for the state, which then turns around and protects them. And in fact, what Al Gore's talking about doing, an implication of what he's saying is, no, you will not be creative if you have multiple children. In fact, we're going to fine you for that.
Right.
If you insist upon going beyond a certain limit, and if you continue to insist upon that, then we're going to do what we call fertility management.
Yep.
Fertility management has a whole lot of implications. It means forced implementation of things like birth control.
Yes, it does.
Forcing women to... and be engaged in things like abortion pills, RU486, whatnot. And not necessarily by force, but convincing them that their life would be much better if they just had fewer children. The Chinese were doing that for a while, and they've suddenly discovered that that wasn't a good plan. Because what was happening was that girls were being aborted in a much higher ratio than boys were. So much for the feminists who argue that abortion is all about a woman's right. In fact, what was happening was the future women of the world were being aborted.
Yes.
And the boys were being kept because culturally they're more relevant because they tend to have higher income streams. They tend to have more to do with success. The problem being that boys who have no girls tend to get kind of ouchy. When there's no women around, the competition goes up, and it tends to make men a little more aggressive. So you create other cultural problems when you suddenly send the ratio of men to women out of balance unnaturally. And let's face it, folks, abortion is not natural.
No, it is not.
So we've got a whole lot of things. There is a lot of the law of unintended consequences at work here.
You're right. You're right. And you know what? I want to bring up something because one of the groups that I work with on a regular basis, the Ridge Project here in Ohio, their founders just had an op-ed piece in the Washington Times. And I think it's a great juxtaposition to Al Gore because they hit on it. They hit exactly where we're going to with this. And they basically say it's that the sexual revolution has spawned disposable families.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to quote a couple of lines from it. It says, it's somewhat ironic that as Washington lawmakers and the Beltway media look back on the 50-year war on poverty, they overlook another equally significant 50-year anniversary that has actually limited the success of the effort, the sexual permissiveness of the 60s cultural revolution. That revolution championed a culture in which rules, responsibility, and the traditional family were disposable. Building strong families is inexorably tied to eradicating poverty. Unfortunately, the revolution of the 60s had more effectively shaped our culture than the war on poverty. Today, we're living in a world where most of the professed goals of the sexual revolution have been realized. We have experienced true, quote-unquote, sexual freedom. The millennials have coined the term friends with benefits. They can do and do hook up at will. Unfortunately, we have found that what was supposed to bring freedom has instead shackled us to activity without meaning.
Wow. Now, I don't know what their theology is. I'm assuming they're Christian.
Yes, they are.
Otherwise, you probably wouldn't be working for them. but there's a lot of what R.J. Rushdoony was talking about 30 or 40 years ago in some of his books.
Yes.
And also Francis Schaeffer.
Yes.
Also Cornelius Van Til. And that's going to be a very obscure. Many of you have heard of Schaeffer almost. Nobody's heard of Van Til. Van Til is who basically Schaeffer borrowed from without bothering to put it in his footnotes.
That's right.
And also R.J. Rushdoony is who Schaeffer borrowed from without bothering to put it in his footnotes. They were talking about this coming while the sexual revolution was still in its development stage.
Right.
Now we're in the end game.
Or close to it, yes.
That's exactly what T. Arenas are talking about. In this revolution has spawned disposable 50 years of liberation has devastated society. This was what was being predicted in the late 60s, early 70s, up through the early 80s. And it's amazing that to see the predictive abilities of those guys 50 years ago and seeing it coming to fruition now, which is what T. Arenas are pointing out.
Now, they work a lot with incarcerated parents, people who are in the justice system, trying to keep those families stabilized while the parent pays back society, if you want to say.
Yeah.
But instead of coming back in order just to go back in again or coming back to become I've paid back society, now society pays me by getting on welfare and things of that nature, they actually work with these families to create economic sustainability and changes in the way they look at their circumstances in their life, and they've been very successful. They've got a fantastic rate, with lowered recidivism, et cetera. It's a great program. But they kind of wrap up their article, and this is on the WashingtonTimes.com. You can go there. It's an op-ed called Sexual Revolution Has Spawned Disposable Families, and by Ron and Catherine T. Arena. Now, they close it out here, and they said, the war on poverty was never intended to become the war on family. Well, I think probably not by the folks who would have believed that we really need to do something about poverty, but for the policymakers, it certainly was.
Well, for the people who came up with the idea and marketed it to the policymakers, yeah, that was their underlying.
That was their underlying issue.
Now, they didn't sell it that way. Yeah. Obviously, you can't sell it that way. What you do is you create talking points that talk about all the positive aspects and basically hide the negatives, because what these guys are doing, you have to remember, we can go back really deep, and you go back to Marxist theology. This is the creation of social science.
Yep.
And these people that came up with these ideas were social scientists with the idea in the back of their minds to completely recreate society, eliminating the influences of faith and recreating a faith in the state.
Yes.
And, you know, Joe Blow, who was sitting in Congress when these things got, and even possibly the bureaucrats who were implementing it, didn't understand it on that basis.
Yeah, didn't understand it at that level. But here, and this is what they say. They say, we're calling on the nation to begin here, to fight for the most disadvantaged families, to create radical changes to policies that have an entrance process but no exit strategy, that sentence families to generational poverty and entitlement. See, they understand what those policies, how those policies were crafted. That's exactly how they were crafted.
Yes.
Said, we look to members of communities across the U.S. to uphold the value and dignity of families and urge our fellow citizens to reclaim and restore healthy relationships and healthy families. It's time to admit that we were wrong. There is no such thing as success or liberty without healthy families. Chuck, they nailed it on the head. I mean, I'm just really impressed because, you know, this popped up. I didn't realize that they were writing this, but I'm glad that they did, because you think about what we just have experienced just this week. The Grammy Awards. Oh, we're going to have 32 homosexual couples, and we're going to put up the stained glass imagery and everything else, and Madonna in a tux, and, you know, a couple of, you know, all of the, let's say, royalty of the left in Hollywood and in the music industry.
With Queen Latifah administering the quote-unquote rights.
Yes. Basically, what we've said is,
yeah,
we are going to attack the family structure, we're going to attack the church, we're going to attack traditional religion, and we're going to do it because we have the power and the control to do so, and you can't stop us. Well, Chuck, what's my mantra? The left always outruns their cover.
Yeah.
I do believe that the Grammy program is a watershed moment, but I don't think it's a watershed moment they wanted.
For them, yeah, it's a watershed moment for us.
I think it's an eye-opening moment of people starting to realize, I can't ignore this anymore. They're coming after me. And they got people have got, our listeners and other, the church has got to understand this. Folks, the only way that they can complete the job of destroying the family is to destroy the one true support the family has, and that's the church. If you can destroy the church, you can finish your job destroying families. You've gone a long way, but there's still that remnant there that you can't eliminate. But if you can shackle or neuter the church of God, which I have to laugh, Charles, because how many tyrants over how many
have tried it?
Thousands and thousands of years have tried to do just that thing, just to find out that, well, as Psalm 2 says, that God sits in the heavens and he laughs at them.
Well, and that's true. If you think about it, the only way they can do it is to co-opt the church.
Absolutely, and that's what that whole thing with the Grammys was all about over the weekend.
Yeah.
Or whatever night that was.
Stalin did it in Russia. Hitler did it. He basically brought the church in under the umbrella of the state, which is why there really is such a thing as separation of church and state. And in the early days of quote unquote Christendom, the church and state very often worked hand in hand. But very often the church did what it was supposed to in Christendom, and that is act as a brake on the power of people who were overstepping their bounds. People have decried the fact that, and we have a movement inside the church now that talks about how awful Christendom was. I think those people don't really understand Christendom very well, what it was all about, what was supposed to go on. Was it implemented imperfectly? Oh, you betcha, baby. And yet, you and I are both Presbyterians, and the fact is that people want the same people who are operating in very often in Presbyterian seminaries want to deny the fact that they supposedly are strong adherents to the Westminster Confession of Faith, which was called into being by a government body during a period of revolution in England. It met by the request and order of Parliament in order to come up with a statement of faith.
Yes.
And a confession of faith that basically everyone could come to an agreement on. And how long did they work on it? I think from 1642 to 1647, something like that, 5 years, I think, they worked on that thing. And then essentially, if you listen to Joe Moorcraft, who we brought in last year to speak, he says it's really not complete. So this is an interesting development. We have to pay attention to the fact that you can't abandon the idea that God is in control and that we have to be obedient to him and give him the glory for these things. And we have to obey him in creating the system that he would have us create.
Yes.
To govern ourselves, because he's not going to come down anytime soon and do it himself. He governs himself through men who are obedient to him and are loyal to him and are conversant in his word. So, you know, where I was going with that, I see how it all ties together. I'm trying to put it in a nutshell in the 3 minutes that we have left.
Well, that's all right. You know, we're going to be talking about this more and more over the next few weeks. Another piece that we didn't even have a chance to get to today, but maybe we'll do on a future program here shortly, is the fact that homosexual activists are pushing right now, and are collecting signatures, by the way, to change the Ohio Marriage Amendment, and they are doing an all-out campaign. They've got money. They've got manpower. They've brought in a campaign manager who ran the successful New Jersey gay, quote-unquote, marriage campaign. Folks, they're serious, and they're coming to a town near you soon because they're having town hall meetings to try to soften up the middle, you know, and that's the way they won in Minnesota
that's
and other
you.
Places. Yeah, they're trying to soften up the middle to make it so that, well, it would just be unthinkable for you to actually speak out against gay marriage because look at all your friends and neighbors, all the white middle class Republicans, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, who are supporting this. You should just get with the times.
Yeah, this is a bandwagon appeal.
But we're going to talk about that in more detail because it needs to be talked about in detail, and we'll do that on a future program. Now, what I think you're talking about here is the fact that when government is running directly counter to to revealed faith, they are an enemy to the faith. And that's really what it gets right down to. And honestly, since our Constitution is based upon biblical principles, when they take an oath to say they swear to uphold and defend against the Constitution against all enemies, both foreign and domestic, by their actions, they're becoming that domestic enemy of the Constitution.
Yeah, my whole point is that not only are people of faith being told to keep it to themselves, we're being told we have no business bringing that into the public square. We're being forced out of the public square. And it's being done with the help of people within the church itself who say, no, you're right, we shouldn't have anything to do with the public square. Going to the point that we had a Douglas Wilson versus David Van Drunen in Dayton some time ago, and I'll see if I can't dig up the links where you can listen to some of these presentations, where Douglas Wilson asked Dave Van Drunen what he thought if God would be pleased that Christians got involved, I believe, in the abortion issue and got a law passed that would outlaw abortion. And he said, no, God would not be pleased with that because it would mean that the church had interfered with the operations of the common grace law.
Right.
That's an absurd position. I'm sorry, that's absurd. And it's, in fact, a dangerous position.
Very much so.
And that's a man, by the way, Dave Van Drunen, who is teaching people in seminary that that's the proper way to think about law and government. Well, I'm sorry, but that's heresy in my view. And I know he thinks my view is heresy because he said so. That's fine.
Yep.
I think I have the Bible on my side, and he will claim he does, but he doesn't. Okay, we're out of time for today. So all that being said, join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.